It is Monday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Mexico elects a new president. As President Donald Trump prepares to nominate a new Supreme Court justice, we look back at the career of retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. And virtual reality filmmaking immerses viewers in global issues. We'll have a report. It's all ahead. Mexico has a new leader, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO, who sought to downplay concerns about his leftist orientation, vowing to pursue an authentic democracy, not a dictatorship.
Reitero el compromiso de no traicionar la confianza que han depositado en mí.
He also said he will search for a relationship with the U.S. based on friendship and development with mutual respect and in defense of immigrants who live and work in that country. President Donald Trump congratulated Mr. López Obrador on his victory, saying he looks very much forward to working with him. AMLO, the first leftist to take hold of power in decades, took more than half the vote in Sunday's election, nearly 54%. His nearest rival mustered only half of that. The election was seen as voter repudiation of the corruption and violence that marked life under previous administrations. Duncan Wood heads the Wilson Center's Mexico department. In Mexico City, he tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he does not see a radical departure from most current policies under Mexico's president-elect.
It's going to be on the economic front. We've had a pretty orthodox economic platform presented during the campaign. Fiscal austerity, financial stability, free trade, bringing in as much foreign investment as possible. On the political side of things, I think that this is an opportunity to actually remake the Mexican political system, remaking it in the sense of going back to an older model of governing Mexico, where you had a hegemonic party, where you had president and Congress controlled by the same party. So we're looking at a presidency where there is a huge opportunity to actually make things happen. But as I say, the overall tendency that I see is actually one of much more of continuity than radical change.
A lot has been made, Duncan, as you know, about the potential clash between President Trump and Mr. López Obrador. Will there be a clash over migration and trade?
It all depends, I think. I mean, Andrés Manuel has been very clear throughout his campaign that one of the most important priorities for him is to maintain a relationship of respect with the United States, that he understands that the economic relationship with the U.S., as well as the political relationship, is of fundamental importance to Mexico's prosperity and security. But, you know, Andrés Manuel is also the kind of figure who will react if there are tweeted insults to Mexico, the Mexican people, or to himself. He's not going to sit there and take it. And you could see the opportunity for a rapid escalation of conflict in a Twitter war. However, I think a lot of this actually comes down to whether or not President Trump wants to continue on his current path and his current trajectory, or whether, in fact, with a new government here in Mexico, he's willing to reach out and offer the olive branch.
Mr. López Obrador has been campaigning, Duncan, on reducing inequality, improving pay and welfare spending while running a tight budget. Can he accomplish those?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do that. He claims that he'll be able to pay for all of these new social programs by cutting corruption and by cutting the fat in the government. And one of his sort of headline programs is that he's going to reduce the civil service, not in the sense of the general workforce, but the altos funcionarios, the high-level officials. He wants to reduce their number by a third. And he says that that in and of itself will save an enormous amount of money that can be put to other purposes. He also claims that he can save around 20% of the federal budget by eliminating corruption, particularly in the procurement process. Most people I speak to are deeply skeptical about whether or not that will pay off, deeply skeptical about whether or not it's possible to eliminate corruption in a country like Mexico. So I think that there's still a huge question mark hanging over his plans for paying for these new programs without actually indebting the country.
That's Duncan Wood of the Wilson Center. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Missing teenage soccer players and their coach have been found alive in a flooded cave in Thailand. The European Union attacks the U.S. threat for higher tariffs on European cars. The FBI arrests a man who planned a 4th of July attack in Ohio, and the Afghan insurgents' bans on polio vaccines could leave more than 1 million children at risk. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Cassini mission, which provided a close look of Saturn, its moons, and famous rings for 13 years, came to a blazing end on September 11, 2017. One of the highlights of the Cassini mission was the 2014 discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above Saturn's moon Enceladus. A team of scientists led by the University of Heidelberg, Germany, studied data gathered by Cassini and identified fragments of large, complex organic molecules containing hundreds of atoms originating from Saturn's icy moon. Cassini had previously detected smaller, more common organic molecules at Enceladus. The scientists say the existence of these large complex molecules, along with hydrothermal activity on the moon, supports a theory that a massive liquid water ocean below the icy crust of Enceladus may provide a habitable environment for life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, U.S. immigrants weigh in on President Trump's immigration policy. President Donald Trump is mulling over selecting a Supreme Court nominee to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's retiring at the end of the month. Trump says he will announce his choice on July 9th. The president said Friday he has narrowed down his list of potential Supreme Court nominees to five candidates, and the five include two women. The retirement of Kennedy, the key swing vote on the U.S. Supreme Court, gives Trump a coveted opportunity to make a second appointment to the nation's highest court. Brandon Bartels is associate professor of political science at George Washington University. I asked him what Kennedy's legacy to the high court will be.
First and foremost, he was perhaps the most quintessential swing justice on the Supreme Court of all time. He rendered highly, highly significant rulings in both the liberal and conservative directions. And on the issue of gay rights, he was arguably the intellectual and doctrinal leader on the court, going back from the 1980s, where he struck down anti-sodomy laws, to 2015, where he authored the majority opinion to legalize same-sex marriage for all 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And before that, he had authored the opinion to strike down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. He also was in the conservative direction on a lot of cases as well. In Citizens United, he voted to strike down the Affordable Care Act. He was in the minority on that ruling. But I would say that would be his biggest legacy, as arguably the quintessential swing justice who brought moderation to an otherwise polarized court consisting of reliable liberals and reliable conservatives.
Yeah, looking back to the late 1980s when he joined the court during the Reagan administration, probably President Reagan wouldn't have thought that he would have turned out to be the way he was.
Right. He was a Californian Courts of Appeals judge. He had been, remember, that was Reagan's third attempt to replace Justice Powell. He had previously nominated Robert Bork, the arch conservative, who was rejected by the Senate 58-42. Then he nominated Douglas Ginsburg, who withdrew due to allegations that he smoked marijuana. And then he went to Justice Kennedy as sort of a safe bet to get confirmation votes from Democrats because the Democrats controlled the Senate at that time. So he was viewed as a right of center, sort of a voice of moderation justice, and started out right of center and then became this quintessential swing justice, along with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. But when she retired and officially left in 2006, he became the lone swing justice on the court.
Well, now looking forward, President Trump will nominate his selection, his choice, to replace Justice Kennedy. Of course, there is a huge amount of speculation over who that person will be. Do you think, and I know this is all just, we're just sort of tossing this around here, but Is President Trump under great pressure to nominate someone who is, say, a fairly hardline conservative?
Yes, I think he is under pressure to nominate what I would call a reliable conservative who will consistently issue conservative votes on the most prominent issues of the day, social issues that the court decides upon. And so these issues are some of the most salient in American politics. You have to remember the historical context. Conservatives have had a 50-year quest to get a reliable conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and they've been highly disappointed over those years with justices who were appointed by Republican presidents who turned out to be liberals, like Justice Stevens, who can basically became the most liberal justice on the court. Justice Souter, nominated by George H.W. Bush, became a solid member of the liberal coalition. Justices O'Connor and Kennedy became swing justices. So there were all these missed opportunities for conservatives to get their reliable conservative majority on the court. And now this is their chance, especially with the Senate change, removing the filibuster obstacle. Now they can just push through a nomination with a bare majority. And so this is their real chance. Now all eyes are on moderate senators like Susan Collins, as well as Democratic senators from red states who are up for re-election this year to maybe pull off some votes there.
Brandon Bartels, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. In the second part of this interview on Tuesday, Bartels discusses the significance of Roe versus Wade in this nomination. An Australian-made camera that can help fight bushfires and monitor the health of the Great Barrier Reef is on its way to the International Space Station. Scientists say the technology will help save lives in natural disasters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The so-called Earth Sensing Imaging Spectrometer was built at La Trobe University in Melbourne and was developed over 3 years by Australian scientists and German engineers. It's one of the world's most advanced cameras, and its images are far superior to current satellite technology. In orbit, the device will take sequences of high-resolution pictures of the Earth's surface that its designers say will help emergency crews fight wildfires through infrared maps. It will also assist in the response to floods, storms, and droughts. The camera's sharp images will be able to measure the runoff of pollutants from land and detect the illegal dumping of chemicals on the Great Barrier Reef that stretches down Australia's northeast coast. The camera was launched Friday from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on board entrepreneur Elon Musk's SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and will take 3 days to reach the International Space Station. Peter Moore, a senior lecturer at La Trobe University, says the launch had to go to plan.
When it comes to space, you've got one shot at it, and that's it. You've got to get it right. This is an advanced instrument for space. This is going to provide imagery to save lives during natural disasters such as fires and floods. It's very difficult to create reliable electronics, hardware and software for space.
Scientists say the device has been built to withstand the punishing extremes in space, where temperatures can fall to minus 270 degrees Celsius. It's scheduled to remain in orbit for 4 years, when it will be brought home and examined to see how it coped in that environment. Authorities in Australia say the project is further proof of a burgeoning domestic space industry. Australia's new space agency began officially on July 1, although a site for the organisation has yet to be found. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
14% of the U.S. population, almost 44 million people, are immigrants. Many are closely watching the immigrant crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border and have strong feelings about the Trump administration's hard line on immigration. Mike O'Sullivan reports from Los Angeles.
At a market in the Little Persia neighborhood, an Iranian-born grocer, Todd Hodadadi, has mixed feelings. He came here as a refugee, but thinks people should enter the country legally as he did.
We pay taxes, and illegal people comes to the country. They work for cash, and they send the money out of the country, and they use all the benefits in this country. You know, I think it's not fair for the citizen of the United States.
Food truck owner Juan Gonzalez worries about the children separated from their parents at the border. He says it's affecting the children. They are under a lot of pressure, and that's not good for them. In central Los Angeles, where many immigrants shop and others own businesses, Chinese merchant Kevin Zhang says Trump is protecting the country, as he should. He says Trump only wishes that drug users and gangs do not come to the United States. Liang Liang, a wholesaler from China, imports T-shirts and novelties and says Trump is doing the right thing.
Because he is the president of America, so he should keep make the country more safe, more strong.
Korean immigrant Hak Sun worries about refugees.
They always be fair, you know. They should help them to, you know, definitely stay in USA.
An immigrant from Nepal, Ramesh Sirawar, agrees the United States should help those fleeing persecution.
Who are really in trouble, like who really needs help or something, they have to give that right to the immigrations.
Trump says Congress should act to clarify issues surrounding detention of illegal immigrants, but an immigrant who grew up in the United States, Tan Wu, has little faith in that.
Democrats are powerless, and then the Republicans, they're just beholden to them. They're afraid to speak up or go against them.
These immigrants, like other Americans, are divided on Trump's handling of illegal immigration, but say they want to ensure that legitimate refugees get help. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. Famine, Feast, Fire, and Ice is a four-part documentary on climate change. The series premiered at AFI Docs, the American Film Institute's documentary festival here in Washington, D.C. It was made using virtual reality technology that gives viewers a 360-degree view of the destructive consequences of climate change on our planet. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with filmmaker Eric Strauss about the impact of virtual reality technology on filmmaking and on viewers.
Melting glaciers and rising seas in Greenland, raging fires in Northern California, the relentless drought in Somalia, and the disappearing Amazon forests. The virtual reality series called Ice, Fire, Famine, and Feast by filmmakers Eric Strauss and Danfeng Dennis immerses viewers into the extremes of Earth's changing climate.
Hopefully, when someone watches the whole series, drives home this idea that there's no hiding from this. This is coming for all of us. Regardless of where we live or what our income is, it's going to affect everyone, and that hopefully drives home the urgency that this is something that all nations need to really pay attention to and start combating.
At the festival's headquarters in Washington, D.C., viewers get a 360-degree view of the effects of climate change through VR goggles.
Some people have a very visceral physical reaction where they jump or they kind of yelp because they're very surprised by what they see. And other people, I think, are very reflective and, you know, can even be sad depending on the content.
Viewer James Willard describes the experience of watching the installment Feast about the deforestation of the Amazon rainforests to make space for industrial-sized cattle ranches to satisfy the global appetite for beef.
You're completely immersed in this whole situation, in this whole story. You're facing these animals eye to eye and watching them as they're marching basically towards their death.
The film needs no dialogue.
Virtual reality is about experience. It's actually kind of stripping away a lot of the information, putting you in environments that you then experience for yourself. You're much more of a protagonist in some way in these types of stories than you would be in a traditional form of cinema.
Another viewer, Patricia, has just watched Famine, the episode that looks at the effects of extreme drought in Somalia.
It just makes it even more powerful because you feel like you're there. And I think it's a great medium to spread the word on critical subjects.
That is the goal, to affect change, to affect positive change.
VR films are becoming more accessible as the technology evolves and are often viewed on smartphone applications. But VR programmer Ken Jacobson says watching them through a virtual reality headset is still the best way to experience them.
I think there'll continue to be developments in the technology of the headset, so pretty soon people will not be so conscious of the headset, and also the optics will improve.
But can virtual reality ever replace the traditional 2D or even 3D films?
I think that it's going to add another aspect to how we're going to experience movies and such, but I don't think that it's going to take over. Virtual reality, I feel like, can be very dangerous at times because you're completely immersing yourself within this story. Some people will be able to take it and then take off the goggles and then live life as normal, but some people might not be able to do so. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to completely take over.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Venezuelan economy is in free fall with soaring inflation and severe shortages of food, water, and medicine. Political opponents of the regime of Nicolas Maduro reportedly have been subjected to imprisonment and torture. Faced with such misery, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have fled their homeland. On a recent visit to Brazil, Vice President Mike Pence noted that Venezuela, once one of the wealthiest countries in the region, is now essentially a failed state. Venezuela's collapse is creating a humanitarian crisis, leading to widespread deprivations, the denial of basic services, and starvation, and it spurred the largest cross-border mass exodus in the history of our hemisphere, Mr. Pence said. To help meet this crisis, the Vice President announced nearly $10 million in additional humanitarian U.S. assistance for Venezuelans who have fled their country. More than $1 million will go directly to support relief operations in Brazil. Over 50,000 Venezuelans have arrived in northern Brazil since 2017. The additional $10 million brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance to nearly $31 million since 2017. The newly announced funds include a contribution to the International Organization for Migration's regional response to the Venezuela crisis, support for the UN World Food Program's emergency response efforts for Venezuelans who have recently arrived in Ecuador, and other humanitarian aid to Venezuelans and host communities in Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and Brazil. Complementing this assistance, the U.S. State Department said in a written statement, is $18.5 million in bilateral funding to support displaced Venezuelans in Colombia who have fled the crisis. The State Department praised the generosity of countries throughout the hemisphere who are hosting Venezuelans escaping the crisis at home and urged additional contributions by all donors to meet their growing humanitarian needs. The State Department also urged countries to increase their support for the restoration of Venezuela's democracy. Vice President Pence noted that as long as Maduro denies democracy and basic rights to his people, Venezuela will continue to crumble. The United States will not stand idly by as Venezuela crumbles, he said. Venezuela deserves better, and the Venezuelan people deserve to reclaim their birthright of libertad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.